Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is a Little Empire podcast. Visit us at littleempirepodcast.com and on Twitter at littleempirepod.
Did you at any time urge former FBI Director James Comey in any way, shape, or form to close or to back down the investigation into Michael Flynn? And also, as you look back...
No. Next question.
Next question.
From the Politics Podcast News Desk in Tampa, Florida, currently spinning along the Tampa to New Zealand axis around which the globe rotates, I am Jeb Lund, and with me as always is Tim Batt. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm very well, and I'm coming to you from my proxy location of Sydney, Australia. I am a Kiwi abroad right now.
You fucked it. Cousins to the north.
I didn't fuck it, man.
We're like less than a minute into this, and you've already done me like that.
Hey, you got to learn to roll, bro. You got to take those Second City lessons to heart.
It's all about riffing
and scatting.
Yeah, well, comedy might be yes and, but journalism is no, but.
No, but I'm right. And if you've got a conflicting opinion, then we're going to battle for sources and I'm always coming out on top. Jeb, it's good to hear your voice, buddy. How
Likewise.
Are you?
I'm good. I'm podcasting up today. I got one done. Why not? As soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm just going to start another. Like, you know, try and stop
Jesus.
Me. Just the ball is rolling.
There's a lot going on at the moment. In kind of reverse order of what we're probably going to talk about today, there's bad news for net neutrality. Good news for people who hate Roger Ailes. That's a very dark way of approaching that.
For people who hate bad news. That's what it should be.
Good news for people who hate bad news. Yeah, nice. There we go. We'll roll with that. And what I previously referred to as like a slow-moving train wreck, which is the Trump administration, is now a really fast-moving train wreck. That seems to be this constantly evolving scandal. And it's an interesting thing where it was kind of like, whoa, he's doing all these crazy things. It's one scandal after another. And now finally, one has been big enough to stick around for more than a week. And it's the Russia investigation and what the connections are. And I mean, we're going to attempt to semi-summarize what is happening in this moment, but it will probably change between now and whenever you hear this. It'll probably change between now and the end of us talking today, Jeb. But essentially, the latest piece of the puzzle that we have from the news is a special counsel has been put forward by the Republican-controlled Senate. Is that the correct parlance for this?
So Rod Rosenstein, who is the Deputy Attorney General, named a special counsel because the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has technically recused himself from any role in the DOJ Russia investigation because he lied before Congress when being grilled by Al Franken, actually, about his contacts with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Kislyak, who had spoken to him in his office and I think spoken to him in Cleveland. It was on two occasions that he had contact with him that he did not admit to. That were then revealed after his confirmation had gone through. So Rosenstein names the special prosecutor, or you can say special counsel. It's pretty much interchangeable. The only thing it's not is independent counsel. So if you're thinking about Ken Starr, it's not the same beast. It doesn't work the same
right.
way anymore.
And the man who has been named is a former FBI director himself. Of course, a lot of the reason why this has hotted up so much is because of the firing of the previous FBI director. So what's his name? Rob? I've heard him called Robbie Three Sticks.
Robert Mueller III. He was named FBI director under George W. Bush, and then he continued. His term was extended under Obama, and he was originally, like, he had another nomination under Clinton in the DOJ. So, like, he's got the imprimatur of three different presidents and a bipartisan pedigree and general esteem across the aisle. So one of the things that he did that you may have seen this in the New Yorker, Jane Mayer had a story that he Bob Mueller stood up at a dinner party when everybody had basically been shunning the a couple of these attorneys who were defending 9/11 defendants. And he stood up and gave a toast to them. This sort of like at the height of you know, we've got to fight back with every tool, damn the law kind of paranoia. And then he was also one of the people who came forward and said the United States is basically abusing its surveillance capacity under W. Bush. So he's got a pretty good track record of being mindful of the Constitution and the law. With, you know, like as much
which
as
will
you can,
make
you can
for
expect.
A lovely departure.
Yeah. I mean, like he's still a cop, right? Like, so, the whole, like, it's really bizarre to watch the American left, or American liberals. It's not really the left kind of going like, hey, we have to defend the integrity of our vast, unaccountable domestic intelligence apparatus. Like,
oh man. It has been so amazing to watch and listen to the mental gymnastics that the left is doing at the moment to try and reconcile its position on James Comey. Because, like, I mean, first of all, for people on the extreme left and you know, certain parts of their consciousness, which I would put myself, who are just, like, by default kind of anti-authoritarian and will hate anyone who's at the top of an administration's, or the top of, like, an intelligence-gathering apparatus, something like the CIA or FBI. I don't think good men rise to the top of those sorts of organizations or seek out power at the high level of those sorts of organizations. Not only that, but in particular, James Comey's decision with how he treated the Hillary Clinton emails, which ostensibly is the reason that has been given by Trump for his firing. So that pissed off all of the liberals because a lot of people believe that that's what cost Hillary Clinton the election. And now he has been made a martyr of the Trump administration. He's been nixed. So now the left is sort of rushing to his aid and defense. And I mean, for all the kind of bullshit that Trump did throw when he fired him, if he had a kind of stayed the course with this one narrative that James Comey did get fired because of his treatment of Hillary Clinton, you and I talked about this in the last episode when it had just happened, the fucking balls on Trump to use that as a reason. But if he had stuck the landing on it and not wavered from that, it would have been so interesting to try and watch all of these left politicians, all these Democrats trying to go, yeah, we did want him fired, but not right now, not by you, and not at the moment. It's like a way harder thing to do. And Trump kind of did create this, not perfect, but pretty interesting and surprisingly strong platform for people to have to attack him at, and then undid his own good work in an interview that he conducted with Lester Holt, where he revealed that he was absolutely thinking of the Russia investigation at the time of firing James Comey. And not only that, but he also revealed that firing James Comey was not contingent on the advice that he received from his Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and the Assistant Attorney General as well, even though that's what he listed in the letter that was the public notification that he had been fired. So, like, Trump, he almost tripped over a smart political play and then fucking 45 seconds later foofed it again.
Yeah, and then, and sort of, like, to further add another twist to this one, Rosenstein spoke in a skiff. He briefed he answered questions from all senators in attendance today who wanted to ask him questions.
Just explain what a SCIF is real quick as well.
It's a secure information facility. Like, that's not what the acronym is for. It's basically like you can make it, you can have portable ones. The Obama administration traveled with one that they would set up in any hotel room. It's basically like a really big Faraday cage that doesn't let any kind of monitoring in. So you can't hear in it. You can't penetrate it with like laser, you know, mics.
Yeah.
You can't.
It's like airplane mode for a room for any device.
Yes. And so, like, basically, that this is why when Trump and everybody, when they had the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at Swamp Versailles, and they were showing him details of North Korea's missile launch, you know, that's why people were so aghast. It's like there was a, you know, the Secret Service has sort of mobile SCIF technology. They could go into a room in Mar-a-Lago with that set up, and instead they were looking at this shit and illuminating it with their Blackberries and iPhones in a public room. So anyway, this is what Rosenstein went into to answer these questions sort of like in camera. And they asked him, when you were drafting the memo You know, Donald Trump has said that he fired James Comey on your recommendation. Then he later told Lester Holt, actually, I was always planning on firing him when you drafted this memo for the reasons why you would fire James Comey. Did you know he was going to be fired? And he said he knew the day before he drafted it.
Yeah, this bit confused me and I haven't quite followed it correctly. So what is the accusation there? That the assistant attorney general had advanced knowledge from where exactly that the FBI director was about to be fired?
Well, he knew that the president desired to fire Comey, and that the purpose of drafting the letter was not to weigh the pros and cons, or, you know, here is an argument for firing him, you know, because you do kind of like do these moot kind of briefs, like, okay, if I were to fire a guy, what kind of reasons would you give me?
Yeah. And so the reason why that's important is because it's putting an outcome before the evidence gathering. It's the Iraq thing. It's going, here's what we want the outcome to be. Now go and find me reasons to justify it, rather than receiving information apropos of nothing from your attorney general and then making a decision based on that.
Well, I mean, I that isn't necessarily unethical. I mean, you're just gaming things out on, like, how is it politically going to play for us? I'm sure, you know, the Obama administration had some briefing papers on, like, what would happen if we fired Hillary, you know? Like,
yeah, but this does contradict the narrative that the Trump administration was putting forward, which is why it's sort of relevant and important that the Assistant Attorney General Rosenstein knew a day before he was getting fired. Is that why that's relevant? Well, I'm just trying to unpick why is irrelevant. But
you're right. I mean, a couple reasons. So there's that, right? So it automatically, you know, Trump wasn't misspeaking when he was bragging to Lester Holt, it was always my intention to fire him. It shows that he had developed the intention to do this. And it also shows that Rosenstein can't say, like, well, this was just sort of like a moot court argument. I was just giving him details. He knew the purpose of it. And he didn't say anything and he didn't do anything about it. So it kind of questions, kind of consonant with a piece that came out in the New York Times by Eric Schmidt, I think, and with, what's his name? Wittes? Guy who runs the Lawfare blog, who is friends with James Comey and was giving some background of how Comey had processed this. It raises the question of, like, how independent Rod Rosenstein is going to be, because if he knew his job was to be a hatchet man and he didn't protest, is it because he felt that the president was automatically kind of like just a priori within, you know, like acceptable boundaries? Or is he a survivor who is going to find a way to navigate the shoals of Trump's temper and outrage from the Democratic minority in Congress and kind of, you know, bend his actions, you know, hereabouts, maybe, you know, not unethically, but really getting kind of close to those dangerous waters. So it's kind of a question of, like, where his autonomy is, because the special prosecutor, the special counsel, Robert Mueller, reports to him. And Rosenstein does have latitude to fire him at any time, or to not deny him resources, or to tell him that his investigatory push in a certain direction is a waste of time. The evidence doesn't bear it out. He needs to focus here. So the question of, like, now, where his spine is important.
I know that the special counsel hasn't been used that many times previously. And in fact, am I right in saying that it's based on a set of laws that was only drafted up and enacted in 1999?
No. Well, yes and no, right? So we've had special counsels going back to the Grant administration. So there was the Whiskey Ring, and then it was used again in Teapot Dome. It was used a couple other times. The next biggest one that you really think of is Watergate, then the Iran-Contra affairs. What happened after Watergate, because Nixon fired Archibald Cox, or he basically kept firing people until somebody would fire Archibald Cox, they set up the independent counsel law. And then so that's what, when you think of Ken Starr, you think of independent counsel. What it did was it preserved the autonomy of an investigation into the president by naming the independent counsel via a 3-judge panel that then gave him virtually unlimited brief. They didn't have to turn in the results at any given time. They didn't have to hew to a certain budget, and they could kind of go anywhere. And so That law lapsed in 1999. Nobody wanted to renew it because Iran-Contra had spread so far afield and caught so many crimes that, you know, thankfully, Poppy Bush was able to pardon so many people out of. And then the Republican minority really twisted the arms of a lot of chicken shit Democrats in the Congress to water down the findings of that report. It was pretty egregious. Then what you saw with Clinton was we got to Monica Lewinsky through Whitewater, through Travelgate. There was an independent counsel, and he concluded there is nothing here. There's nothing I can charge the president with. And the Republicans said, well, we're going to fire him until we find a person to replace him with who will find something. Then they hired Ken Starr. And then years later, you wind up with the dress. And I don't know what the definition of is. And then a year after that, the law lapsed because Ken Starr was, you know, basically just sort of he was going all over the place and turned up all this evidence that led to an impeachment, didn't lead to a conviction in the Senate because it was partisan bullshit. And then Ken Starr, the Puritan who was so aghast by this, then went on to preside over Baylor University, which now is up to like its 60th rape cover up.
I feel like we've diverted a little bit, but this has been a law on the books for a long time, that sort of provisions of which sunsetted in 1999 and were changed a little bit at that point.
Yeah. So like what happened in 99 was they basically put the ability to kind of like convene or name a special prosecutor back under the DOJ. So it's under the aegis of the Attorney General, in this case, Session, who is recused. So it falls to Rosenstein. But Rosenstein can fire the guy, although in this case, he probably will not. And there, that's a twist. But Trump can fire him.
There's sort of the straight laws and reporting line for this. And then there's the politics of it. The fact that Robert Mueller has been named is the person who, as you rightly point out, is this guy of, great repute from both sides of the aisle. He is the only FBI director since Hoover who's had more than a 10-year term, because there is a term limit on that position, which happened as a result of Obama, a decision that he made, because there were two other senior positions. I can't remember what they were. It was like the head of the CIA and another, maybe the NSA or something like that, were also being replaced at the same time. And he needed some sort of some huge position of intelligence gathering to have a bit of continuity through that period. So kept him on for an additional 2 years. And just like an interesting little quirk of his history as well is Robert Mueller was brought on a week before 9/11 to be the FBI director. So that was his introduction into the role. And he managed to, on the fly, sort of grab the reins of that organization and change it into a way where they could reposition their resources and deploy personnel to counterterrorism, whereas before it was dealing with a lot more sort of different internal threats and bank robberies and things like that. But it seems like for Trump to be able to fire Robert Mueller would be, I mean, we say everything's untenable and it's happened so far anyway, but I mean, let's just try saying it again. It would be pretty fucking batshit for Trump to try and touch this guy now, right?
Yeah, and I think, honestly, like, I think Rosenstein naming Mueller is kind of a fuck you, because Trump and the whole White House communications staff put it on him for the Comey firing. Like, well, you know, he brought us this draft that said, you know, here's why you should fire him. So we did it on his recommendation. And especially if he knew a day ahead that they were going to do it anyway and they were just looking for cover, and then to put it on him and see if they could get away with it, I imagine that would really piss you off. And so he needed to cover his ass in a way. And I think he, you know, this is like the way this happened, there's so many fuck you elements to it. The White House wasn't given notification of the fact that the order, commissioning Mueller as special prosecutor had been signed until 30 minutes before it was, you know, the world was going to be told. So they only got 30 minutes of prep. He picked this.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He picked this august name, right, that has so much bipartisan respect that it's almost like, go ahead and fire him, see what happens.
Yeah. Right?
So it's. And the thing is,
but that's like, the whole point, right? Like, that's what you want in a special prosecutor, someone who is beyond reproach in the eyes of the public, no matter what your political leaning is. That is precisely the kind of person you want in that role, someone who's untouchable.
Right. And the other thing, too, is like Rosenstein, because Trump allegedly, you know, did it on his on like Rosenstein's advice and then changed his story and then might have been planning all along to do it to shut up and stop the Russia investigation. That then makes Rosenstein potentially a co-conspirator in obstruction of justice. So he needs to, you know, he needed to name a special prosecutor just because his role and judgment is tainted, and he needed to recuse himself every bit as much as Sessions did. So he's not going to fire. I would be stunned if he fired Mueller. And it seems as if he picked like the one person that almost everybody, you know, even the idiots in the Trump White House who don't understand how shit works would go like, wait a minute. Like, so yeah, I just,
we should lay hands off of this guy. Hey, let me ask you a question, Jib. How do you feel about the fact that, and I'm going to be borrowing some Breitbart talking points for a second, the fact that we haven't seen evidence of this James Comey memo, which he supposedly wrote on the day of him meeting up with Trump for dinner, where there's these two conflicting reports of the conversation that they had. Comey, and we know this by the journalists' accounts who have claimed to have seen this document that James Comey has written, according to their version, according to James Comey's version of events, Trump asked Comey for his loyalty and to let go of this investigation into Mike Flynn on the basis that Mike Flynn was a good guy. And according to Trump, that was not sought, I think. I'm not even 100% sure on what their version of events is, but there is a confliction there. So firstly, can you fill in the gaps on what I can't remember about what the Trump version of how that conversation or dinner went? And also, what do you think about the absence of us having cited this supposed memo so far, but so much stock being put into it?
Well, okay, so the Trump narrative is that thrice he asked Comey if he were under investigation, and thrice Comey in the garden at Gethsemane denied him. He asked, am I under investigation? Comey reassured him three different times he wasn't, and then he got fired because what he did to Hillary Clinton was bad, blah, 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 blah. Comey's assertion is that he fired, he filed a daily briefing or a memorandum immediately upon leaving his meeting with Trump. And in fact, he was in some of these cases doing it in his car, like just because the stuff was so fresh and he couldn't take notes and he didn't want to record it. Like his story hasn't changed. He hasn't come out, you know, he's let surrogates promote it. But like the Republican, like, why have we not seen this document is actually already abutting one of their other talking points, which is, we should shut down the Senate and the House investigations into this because Mueller's investigation and his subpoena power is stronger than these congressional panels. And people are not going to want to cooperate with with us in public about an ongoing investigation that for like ethical reasons they shouldn't comment on. So we shouldn't even do these things because we're not going to get anything important, and people will be bound not to cooperate. At the same time, they're saying like, well, where's James Comey's memorandum? It's part of a fucking ongoing investigation. So that's
It's the fact that all these journalists have said that they have seen it, and I don't doubt that whatsoever, but I just think like there is something about the Russia hysteria that's kind of gripping America at the moment, and the fact that so much stock is being put into this document that we haven't cited firsthand yet.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of other good examples of sort of like phantom documents that everybody kind of is aware of. I'm trying
those
to
11
right
pages
now.
About Saudi Arabia from the 9/11 report.
Yeah. Although we've never seen like the level of detail of the president asked me if I would be loyal and if I could drop this.
I
mean, that is an oddity, but I mean,
because as someone who is a political journalist, like from that point of view, is that something that bothers you at all, that the public has been so captured and that emotions are running so high based on a document that hasn't been cited firsthand? Or are you pretty comfortable with that being the case? It's just, it kind of concerns me about the direction we're all heading in our news consumption and how much evidence we need to get really whipped into a frenzy these days.
Well, I mean, I guess I'm not that worried about it because the, you know, everything about Trump demanding loyalty from people and him asking for that and prizing that first and, you know, competency second, in a way, he's very Clintonian that way. Yeah. But that, you know, that isn't new. That's very old. And I don't think
I get that it's congruent. I totally do get that it's congruent. And for the record, like, I 100% believe that this memo exists. And I also believe that Comey's account is totally right. But it's more just this kind of philosophical thought experiment about, like, should we be putting so much of our collective mental resources and energy into something based on a document that we haven't seen out in the public yet?
Well, okay. I mean, so the other thing is, like, I was kind of curious about this. I was tempted to go back and listen to whatever episode we did was most proximal to Comey's addressing Congress and seeing how pissed we were at him, because I like to think that my take on him has been consistent the whole way through, that this was a bureaucrat covering his ass and that that's who this guy is. And I think if you look at, you know, his sort of history under the Bush administration with the Ashcroft memo, and then with the last minute update on Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin and Clinton, and then this, I mean, it just seems like this guy behaves the same way every time, and maybe he's a little bit of chicken shit, but he's consistent. So I'm okay with speculating from there. I mean, my attitude, like, is still, you know, Russia is not going to save you. Impeachment is not going to save you. This conspiracy is not going to save you. All the real problems are still going to be there on the ground to people who are poor and can't sit all day, like, refreshing their Twitter feed and watching MSNBC. Yeah. So, like, I'm not really pinning shit on this, but, like, I feel like it's probably real. It probably says exactly what we think it says. And it's probably, you know, as it, like, the unseen document is still as probative as the actual seen one, which is not until we get some things corroborated by other people, because it is going to be a he said, regardless.
Mm. I want to throw another question at you, just kind of a more fun one. And I am stealing this from another podcast. I can't remember. It might have been 538 or something else. But I want to ask you, Jeb, which of the following options do you think is the most likely? Do you think that Trump's going to be able to remain in power and see out his 4 years? Or do you think he will A, die, B, quit, C, get impeached, or D, the 25th Amendment will be enacted and we will possibly get President Pence, but more likely President Paul Ryan, or perhaps Orrin Hatch?
I think he either serves out a term or he quits, but I don't think either of the other two are going to happen. And I think it's going to depend on the attitude of the Republican Congress, whether he quits. Because if there's no threat of impeachment and it comes down to an obstruction of justice charge and the people around him were nefarious, the Republican Congress is going to have every incentive to demand their resignation or firing and leaving him in place, because the only other option is, like, you clean house and you install Paul Ryan, who has the nation is not going to like him. And they will take a battering in the midterms. They're not going to have, you know, they're going to have a lame duck president, would be my guess.
I kind of think that's a given no matter what happens. Now, here's a question that's just occurring to me now. If they roll Trump now, if Trump steps down, like, today, is there, and it's kind of hard to take a long-term view of this right now while we're in what appears to be the eye of the storm right now, do you think that there is a potential way that they have enough time to spin this into some sort of victimization story? Because if Trump can stand down, does that stop certain aspects of the investigations that are going on into his connections with Russia? And can they, at least in the eyes of enough people, turn Trump into being a victim of this witch hunt, which is the new catchphrase that he and his surrogates are using? Is there a way for them to spin this that he has been this historical victim of the left and centrists who didn't have the gall to see government really change?
I think they might try it with almost anybody else. I don't think they can do it because he'll fuck it up, right? Like, You know, if he's out of office and all he has to do is resent being an ex-president, that motherfucker is not going to stop talking, and he's going to blow every talking point they try to engineer. When he's president, they have no choice but to do what he says, right? Like the whole idea that we have, you know, three branches of government to balance for, you know, liberty and justice, right? Like that goes out the window when your guy is in charge, right? So, and your party doesn't expect you to do anything but obey. So they can kind of, you know, they can do these sort of half-assed talking points and kind of go like, what are we going to do? You know, you can already see how half-hearted they are about this shit. Like the only talking points they really kind of keep hammering at are like, well, why don't we prosecute these leakers? And, you know, like, well, we think that, you know, this is an attempt to distract from how successful the president's agenda has been. And we can't, you know, it's like Bill Belichick after a loss, you know, in a press conference, like it's on to the Cleveland game, you know, only it's on to tax reform. It's on to tax reform. You know, they either want to change the subject or blame the press. They don't really have anything else to work with because he's going to blow up whatever their, you know, if they have a full court press today, there's no telling how much he might have fucked it by like 9 a.m. by tweeting at, you know, 6:35. So they don't really want to venture anything. But as long as he's in power, that kind of like that obviates that removes some of that, you know, responsibility, which is great. They love that. Everybody loves that.
Another thing I want to ask you about is how screwed Pence is quickly becoming, because he was kind of screwed before, but in an unknown cloud kind of way. And as we're getting more information, it seems like he's more and more screwed. Now, shit, I'm going to kind of screw this up, so please just jump in and correct me. But Michael Flynn announced his intention to file as a foreign agent in like October or something. And so because Pence was the head of the transition team, he absolutely should have known that. And I think he came out in March in the media and said in an interview on a news show that it was the first he was hearing of Mike Flynn registering as a foreign agent. Is that...
It is categorically false. He's so screwed. Yeah. Like he's fucked. Like, So, I mean, he's got, so, you know, he's been informed by Sally Yates. Flynn himself had been issued something by like the DOJ or saying like, you know, listen, you're in default of this registry. You need to take care of it. So he already knew. And like literally the text, I mean, the actual memorandum that he sent is like bold and underlined on that account, like literally in the text.
That Flynn sent to the Trump campaign?
That was sent to Flynn. So he, you know, he can't deny knowing it. And then he reported it to the Trump people. And he said, I shouldn't do this.
Last year.
He was holding out for like a different job. And then Trump insisted on pressing him into the NSA position anyway. There were multiple warnings to everybody involved. Pence is an extraordinarily bad liar. He's never been like that bright of a man. He's a good radio guy. I mean, so he's better than I am at that. But like, and I apologize to everybody. But like, that's it. I can't imagine like the Trump people, if he tries to like skate through and be like, well, I'll be president, you know, and you'll get impeached. Like those fuckers are going to turn on him. It's going to be like when the Warner Brothers cartoon, like when it's like Daffy and Bugs in a lifeboat on the open ocean and like Bugs looks at Daffy and he just turns into a fucking roast turkey. It's going to be that. Like Pence is going to be a full Thanksgiving spread for, I mean, these guys are all in charge now and they can't stop knifing each other in the back. You know, that dude thinks he's going to skate. He's going to get shivved by like 22 people.
Oh my God. So damn, man. Like what is going to happen to Mike Pence? Is he going to fight? Because,
he's going to go home to mother.
Yeah, but will he? Because who was it? Lindsey Graham came out and has announced that in all likelihood this is a criminal investigation. And I mean, if it is for anyone, it's got to be for Pence. He's the guy, he was literally the head of the transition team. He is the person who would have been receiving this information that Flynn was A, under investigation, and B, announced his intention to register as a foreign agent, and they still put him in that position. Like he's right at the center. So I mean, I don't know what the charge would be, but could Pence go to jail as well?
I mean, the theory, like the one
I kind of he perjured himself, right? Like, he said to the public from, I think he might have been on Meet the Press. Said that this is the first I've heard of it in response to the foreign agent thing with Mike Flynn in March.
Well, that's not court, though, right? Like, you can't perjure yourself in front of MSNBC or whatever. Or no, it was Brett Baier, you know, so.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah, I mean, and like, he can always claim that he misheard. I mean, the two options that they have is for like, for Trump and Pence is either, you know, deny everything or plead staggering ignorance. And I wouldn't be surprised if they go for the latter for both of them. You know, like, with everything in disarray, it's like, well, I wasn't adequately prepared by my team. You know, obviously I'm the head of the transition, but I rely on reports from other people. I didn't get that. And they have a lot of time to shred things. I mean, you know, this is.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Going to be, you know, chaos, but like, yeah, he's tainted by all of it. So if Trump goes, I can't imagine how he stays unless he can somehow, you know, paint himself to the press as this holy fool who just doesn't know shit about fuck. And
but based on what you're
president.
Saying based on what you're saying, he does go home to mother instead of getting the pokey.
Yeah, it's America. We don't actually like send we don't send white collar criminals to jail.
Yeah, god damn it. Very good. All right, hey, well, let's take a short break now, Jeb, and we'll come back and talk about the exciting world of net neutrality.
Okay.
The FCC's vote to implement strong net neutrality rules was an important victory for American consumers and for American business. And that victory demonstrated the overwhelming power of grassroots activism and civic participation. In 2014, millions of Americans from across the political spectrum organized to ensure that their voices were heard, and in the process, they redefined civic engagement in our country.
Well, I'm sorry to say we're going to have to scrap the whole of that previous segment. While we were on break, three more people got indicted.
God damn it. Welcome back to politics, everybody. That is the fast-paced world we're living in right now. And I want to talk about something that has been quite fast-moving today. And Jeb and I are probably going to slightly fuck up in our discussion of it because it's a little bit hard to get your head around this unless you're really into it. But net neutrality is an issue that is unfolding. Firstly, the principle of net neutrality is that all data on the internet should be treated equally and that internet service providers should not have an ability to be able to slow down data or speed up other data just because of where it's coming or what it relates to. So in a real world example of this, you cannot have AT&T prioritize traffic going to YouTube servers so that the video you grab from YouTube appears faster, there's less buffering, you can get it in 4K, it's in better quality than if you were to get your video from, say, Vimeo, because of some deal where YouTube gave AT&T a bunch of money. The principle behind that is this is how monopolies occur and grow and be able to stifle competition in the marketplace. They're able to use their massive war chests, which they've accumulated, to solidify their positions instead of actually having a better product than competitors in the marketplace. And so the net neutrality argument centers around principles of how much involvement should the government have in being able to enforce that open playing field, that open market, that even keeled environment that we can all put our products and services on. So what happened today, and the reason this is back in the news, is the FCC had a vote to remove basically the broadband provisions away from Title II regulation. Now, Title II relates to a specific part of the Communications Act of 1934, whereby broadband was classified as something called a common carrier. And a common carrier is something that all the people in the country use. Its actual definition that I'm going to read to you from Wikipedia is a person or company that transports goods or people for any person or company and that is responsible for any possible loss of the goods during transport. A common carrier offers its services to the general public under license or authority provided by a regulatory body. Basically, from a legal point of view, it is something that is so important to the infrastructure of the country that the government feels it has to act as a sort of a legal guarantor to its correct usage and sort of safe practice out in the marketplace. So it's things like mail and electricity and water. These are important things that the government needs to get involved with so that people don't get screwed. We previously had the chairman of the FCC was a man called Tom Wheeler, who actually, when he first became the chairman, which from memory I think was in 2011, there was a big brouhaha about it. And most people who were sort of defenders of net neutrality, which, I mean, if you think it's a niche topic to talk about now, back then no one was really thinking about it except for mega nerds. They were very fearful about what was coming down the pipe with Tom Wheeler because he was the head of two separate industry lobbies for the telecommunications industry. He had come from a very sort of a private background. Came into the role under Barack Obama and actually, much to pretty much everyone's surprise, championed principles of net neutrality and in 2015 got broadband under Title II, reclassified as a common carrier, which gave it this protected status. Now, the chairman of the FCC under Donald Trump is a new guy called Ajit Pai, who has been made fun of extensively, mainly because of his mug. His actual coffee mug, not his face, by John Oliver. And he's an interesting dude. He's quite a weird dude. He's very easy to make fun of because he is quite odd. But he is a guy who has put forward a more libertarian argument in defense of getting rid of what he would describe as a heavy-handed government approach to net neutrality. Basically, his argument goes that the marketplace should be allowed to operate how it wants. It's all about free market forces being able to deliver the best product for consumers, which I'm actually sympathetic to in some ways, except for the fact that the broadband market, particularly in America, or we'll call it the internet market, is so fucked and so far from a free market to begin with that I think these regulations need to go in to counteract the market position that things like AT&T have, where so much of the American population do not have a choice in who their broadband provider is going to be. Ajit Pai's whole argument for having an open market and letting the market decide and the consumers being empowered to be able to choose where they're going to put their money and what ISP they're going to back based on their offerings, it kind of falls down when you don't have any choice in the marketplace. And that is the current internet environment in the States. Jeb, feel free to jump in anytime want. I know that this isn't quite your area of expertise and nor mine, to be honest, but it's an interesting thing that's happening at the moment and kind of the death bell is being rung at the moment for net neutrality based on this vote that happened today.
Yeah, so like the thing that, like for all listeners not in the United States has abysmal broadband. And basically, the way we get cable internet, the way we get broadband internet is because usually about, 40 years ago, local jurisdictions created monopoly, provisional monopoly status to companies to lay cable because the government didn't want to pay for it. Because people didn't have cable, you didn't necessarily know it was going to be a winner, people who didn't want to watch TV weren't going to pay to underwrite laying cable for other people who wanted to pay extra to watch TV. After all, like you put up a fucking aerial and, there were only three networks and they all came through from the aerial on your house and that's all it cost. So there were these sort of provisional monopolies created to lay the cable and then these companies got a bonus cost on leasing, the use of these cables back to provide cable to everybody. What it has effectively created in almost every city in America is either an absolute monopoly or maybe a duopoly in some places. I don't know what the third one is, triopoly. I don't know. But usually the third option, if it exists, is sad. So like where I live, you can get, Fios Verizon, which because they went ahead and spent a ton of money to go ahead and lay it down on their own, or what was laid down originally, which is now managed by Time Warner Cable. It's now called Spectrum. You might have heard the term Roadrunner. But, you know, in America, you've got basically Fios, Time Warner / Spectrum or Comcast. And that's it. Those are your three. And then if you live in like a random town, there might be like Dale's Cable that services like a neighborhood. But the effect is that you pay this, you know, they offer different services, but you pay pretty much the same rate. You have no choice. They say that you get, you know, this many megabits up and down. You never do. It never comes anywhere close. There is no consumer accountability in that regard. The neighborhood that I live in was not originally wired for fiber optics. So we had cable and they just never made an attempt to boost the signal here. So when kids come home every day, if you're watching a streaming movie, that will grind to a halt because they come home and they start playing video games.
And there hasn't been the incentive for the industry to pick its shit up off the ground and invest in that infrastructure and allow people to get higher speeds and more reliable services. And just to tack on what you were mentioning before, like in a lot of America, how you do have one or two or three options, and that sort of can be viewed as a duopoly. It's also kind of a cartel, because there have been a lot of cases that have come to light where really, like, probably illegal business practices are going on, where various bits of the country are being carved out individually by these top tier ISPs like Comcast, who will go, look, you can have this part of the West Coast if we're allowed to have these cities here, and we won't compete on each other's ground, so we can both screw the consumer to the max and make a shit ton of money. Like, that stuff is going on right now.
Well, and a lot of that too is the effect of when they were given, like, let's say, a charter to install this, right? It was done on a county government by county government basis. So, like, you can go from, let's say, Tampa, Florida, which is Roadrunner territory, and then you cross over into Sarasota County, and boom, everybody has Comcast. Just because that's who, you know, or Comcast maybe bought it from whatever the local provider initially made the outlay. Whatever the case, none of these companies have any interest in spending money on that kind of physical infrastructure. It's extraordinarily costly, and the cost, it's paid back, it's amortized over time. And what they've done is essentially sort of locked prices. And if they go more expensive and you happen to have that duopoly there, as soon as somebody's contract is up, they'll just switch to the other one. So it's almost like somebody's waiting to force their hand. And of course, the Republican response is to not do that at all, but instead to find another way to monetize this existing digital infrastructure where, you know, you can pay extra to, you know, prioritize your data packets and deprioritize others, which will inevitably lead to the democratization of the internet. God.
And Ajit Pai is claiming that that won't happen, that we won't see that. But I think you only need to have a rudimentary understanding of economics to see that that's exactly what will come down the pipe. And in not even that long an amount of time. We're already seeing little bits of the principles of net neutrality being chipped away. I'm in Australia at the moment, and actually we've got this in New Zealand as well, where certain mobile carriers here won't charge you for streaming Spotify data, or they won't charge you for Netflix data. And T-Mobile did a similar thing a couple of years ago in the States and probably still have the plan. And even that, though, for some people, it's not strictly considered anti-net neutrality. It is sort of against the spirit of net neutrality, in that it is getting data coming from one particular service or company and giving it special treatment over data coming from another. And one of the beautiful things that has allowed the internet to flourish and become this incredibly dynamic space that offers so many crazy, weird services in such a short amount of time is the fact that people could get on there and it was the strength of the idea which would gain it popularity. You didn't need a huge amount of infrastructure because everything was just there. When Sir Tim, what's his name? Berners-Lee, the guy who kind of is credited with created the World Wide Web, when he first sort of built the infrastructure of it, he had the option to charge money for its use, and he made the physical decision to not do that. He could have been probably richer than Bill Gates at this point, but he didn't do it because he understood these principles of not stifling an open environment where a good idea would get ahead and people could build on that idea and they could, you know, have open discussion about what service will come next and collaborate together and not be tied down by someone having a faster speed or a better ability to provide a service just by virtue of being able to pay money to the ISPs. And like, while I do get the libertarian in me does see what Ajit Pai is saying and I do understand his argument, I just think that the internet market in the States is so fucked that certain steps do need to be taken to at least protect its position from not getting more fucked than it already is right now and hopefully start to unwind just how fucked it is. And in terms of market forces, Google is actually a pretty good example of a service that is forcing a lot of these big companies' hands. But we can't keep relying on these huge corporations to hopefully come in and fill these voids. Because if Google hadn't started throwing their gigabit connections around in just random towns and cities to try and take on the Comcasts of the world, there would be no movement. And there's examples all across America where these big fat ISPs have just been creaming people with shitty services and high bills for years and years and years. And then Google announces that they're bringing a gigabit connection in and suddenly they start changing their plans to be more competitive. And it takes that. And that's a wonderful thing. And that's how free markets work. But in the case of the broadband market in America, it's so fucked at the moment that to rely on a big corporation to accidentally provide some altruism and competition in the market, it's just like the stakes are too high. And I don't have a huge amount of faith in government agencies to be able to regulate everything, but this just seems like one of those places where sensible regulation needs to prevail, and it's not going to because of the ideology of the government that's in charge at the moment.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, if you're relying on these companies to create this, those are the exact same companies that will stand to have the most direct benefit from the erosion of something like net neutrality, right? If you have the money to sink into mass infrastructural projects to, you know, extend, you know, inexpensive Wi-Fi to everybody, you're also the company that has the wherewithal to buy a lot of lobbyists and say, you know, listen, we did you this favor, so we get preferential treatment. And once you kind of start introducing those exceptions, then they start to come down like dominoes. And like the other thing I just kind of want to do to contextualize this is, like, if you listen to the rhetoric about why net neutrality needs to go, it is the exact same rhetoric against Obamacare. Like, it's the same Orwellian cant. And that's A, an indicator of like how blatantly evil it is, but B, it's an indicator of just how banal it is as well, right? Because if we get rid of net neutrality, you're going to have more services and more options. And if we get rid of Obamacare, you'll have more services and more options. Like, these people will be incentivized to come in the marketplace and give you more things. Fuck no, they aren't, right? Like, the reason why Obamacare was created was because the insurance company said, hey, listen, we have no interest in losing money on insuring sick people, which is the point of fucking health insurance, is spending money on sick people. So they devised all these ways to get around it. Likewise, you've had these permissible monopolies for decades that said, we have no net interest in providing you more goods or services because we can agree to essentially charge the same prices for the same substandard service. Because the question with insurance is, are you going to pay more for this shit that doesn't pay out when you get sick? Or are you going to die? And the other question is, are you going to pay more for this shit that like prioritizes Comcast and NBC Universal and YouTube and all these other packets of data over you? Or are you never going to go on the internet again? And they know you don't have a choice. So it's that, you know, you can eat shit or you can die. Which one do you want to do?
And it can seem like melodrama to link people's access to free and open internet to healthcare. But I mean, it's like, we've only just gotten to the point where the public's starting to understand now, the general public, how important internet is to our everyday lives and that this is actually a fight worth having and not just some nerd shit that all the geeks are talking about. So
let me liken it to one more concrete thing, right? And because maybe you don't know about this, and certainly I don't know if New Zealand's going through anything similar. The U.S. Postal Service has a budget crisis now. The reason why it has a budget crisis is because the lame duck Republican Congress in 2006 that had just gotten walloped by the Democrats decided to create a budget crisis. And they said that the pension system for the USPS had to be fully funded over the next 50 years. Now, like, no other government agency in America is required to be fully funded. So by doing that, suddenly 50 years of debt, full debt manifested on its books that it no longer had, you know, because suddenly it had this expense it never had before. And that immediately, because the Postal Service was in crisis, immediately engendered conversations about how best to compensate for that. And the first one is, well, let's privatize it. And the example is, well, look how inexpensive it is to use UPS or use FedEx. Well, the reason why UPS and FedEx are competitive is because the U.S. Postal Service is there. You know, as soon as it's gone, they can jack up the prices. As soon as you remove that kind of, and the USPS, this is a fucking marvel of government and engineering. If you live within a zip code that's designated, if you don't, you know, you may have to drive into a post office. But if you live within a zip code, you will pay the exact same rate anywhere in the continental United States for anything within the exact same weight and postage class. And if you, you know, a first class piece of mail, you know, when I grew up, it was like 25 cents. Now it's, I mean, I don't know. I buy forever stamps now, right? But like,
Old man Lund over here.
Like, you can be anywhere in the U.S. and it will show up at the, you know, the address in 2 days. That's tremendous. And it's a reminder of like what government does for people in a good way. And like, people have a positive association with the fact that there's a mailbox there that they can use to communicate anywhere in the world. And their piece of mail is no more or less valuable than anyone else's unless they spend a bunch of money like to make it so. But like, the standard first class data packet, a letter, is treated equally, right? And this, so basically, like, the whole net neutrality thing is part of a larger umbrella of let us attack public services. Let us attack this idea that everybody is democratically entitled to certain things by basically coming up with a bunch of fake talking points about how they're not getting even better services. And once you remove that democratizing element, and that in one very basic case stabilizes prices and services and gives people a very concrete idea of what they are guaranteed, the minute you can do that, you can step in as a private company and go, you know, actually, you know, not wet mail is bonus mail. So you're going to need to spend $5 extra per month so it doesn't show up looking like cottage cheese. You know, because there's no longer going to be a competitor as a guarantor. I mean, the same thing, you can go like examples with the National Rail. As soon as they privatized rail in England, you know, the prices shot up, the services diminished because, you know,
we've got an amazing history in New Zealand of that happening. Every time a centre-right government comes in, they sell the rail service. And then as soon as we get our centre-left government, because everyone got bored, we have to buy it back at a huge loss and then revamp it all because it just fell to ashes under the stewardship of the private market, which put no money into reinvesting into their infrastructure. Yeah, it's a good analogy. And that is,
It's so, just they changed the buzzwords, but it's the same idea that, like, you know,
the
government guaranteeing a service to you is a bad idea because the government is technically you, doesn't have a, you know, a vested interest in fucking you the way a company does.
And look, don't have a huge amount of faith in the government to undertake massive projects, but the whole argument of having a baseline of services across the board for really important shit like healthcare and broadband that people can kind of start at, this is the government mandated basement on services, and then work your way up above that, I think is kind of a good idea. So this vote has happened. It's just a vote in the FCC commission, so this isn't like a rule change just yet. There's going to be a 90-day comment period. There was a huge comment period preceding this vote, which the FCC, from what it looks like, completely fucked up. They stopped taking comments after a little while after John Oliver set up the Go FCC Yourself automated form website referral service. I think their wording was, we are going to stop taking public comments and reflect for a time.
Well, part of that was because somebody set up bots that was registering people without their consent, opposing net neutrality in general, not supporting, you know, not opposing the movement to end net neutrality. So there's like somebody with some money set it up, so a bunch of citizens were going, we hate this. So that was fun.
And anyway, that's sort of where it's at the moment. You're probably going to find a more credible boiling down of that somewhere else, but that's our take on it. Let's not have another break, Jeb, because we've been going really long, but I just want to touch on the last big thing that's happened the last couple of days, which is the passing of Roger Ailes, who created the Fox News Network. And it was interesting because I was messaging you about this earlier today, and I said to you, do you want to do like a Roger Ailes obituary? And you said that is a ghoulish approach to a man dying. And you know what? You're fucking right, Jeb. I've been so caught up in how we sort of talk about this shit, the zeitgeist of discussing figures on the right and conservative media figures, that it is easy to forget sometimes that these are people with flesh and blood and families, and a man has just died. And there have been a lot of very powerful pieces, some of which I've read in places like Rolling Stone, about what a bad man he was and what a terrible legacy he has left behind for us, and basically fertilized the ground for figures like Trump to take the reins on a sort of a field of bad information and hysteria and, you know, just fear, basically fostering fear everywhere. But what is your take on Roger Ailes' legacy and the fact that he has died now?
Well, first of all, like the ghoulish thing, it was more, you know, anytime somebody on the right dies, because I did a couple of good obituary pieces with my friend Dan O'Sullivan, people are like, hey, I want you, you know, I need you to spit on this guy's grave right now. And
yeah,
it's work. I mean, like the first one we did for love of the sport, and, you know, because there was also, we wrote one about Andrew Breitbart called Big Deal, Big Coronary, Big Corpse. But that's because, God, like, everybody was giving this guy a blowjob, and this guy was fucking scum. And yeah, and it was like, no, 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 he doesn't get away with it. You know, Ailes isn't going to get away with it. Everybody considers him scum. The man was fucking poison. I don't care. He has a family, and they miss him. Fuck him. Fuck them. I don't care. Like, they, you know, if you live with this guy and you didn't know he was an asshole, you're part of the fucking problem. More to the point, like, you know, are you a black guy in America? You know, you probably have a family. Well, Roger Ailes didn't give a shit what happened to you. Like, I've never heard an, you know, apology from Roger Ailes to any person of color that he base whose lives he made hell for the last 20 years. Yeah. So no, fuck him. I mean, like, this guy.
And not right, to mention, not to mention the fact that he was, in all likelihood, a sexual abuser as well
for 50 years. Let's put it. I mean, like, put it in perspective. He has been sexually harassing and probably sexually assaulting women since he worked as a producer on the Mike Douglas show in the 60s. He took the experience that he learned there to sell Richard Nixon. So you can go read Joe McGinnis's book, The Selling of the President. Ailes basically came up with, and this is something that they used with Reagan and then they've used with Trump extensively, and it's become part of the Republican playbook. He filled these pre-selected audiences with a telegenically diverse group, and then had people with certain questions already set up that were right within Nixon's wheelhouse. Nixon got full TV makeup and everything so he didn't look sweaty and awful. He went out there and he seemed to be interacting with the crowd, but what he was doing was he was interacting with plants. At the end of it, those people were ushered past journalists so that it was difficult for journalists to figure out how real they were. You know, it was basically these little Potemkin villages of Americana where Nixon would appeal to this, you know, demographic cross-section and look good. That helped to get him elected. In the 70s, he was part of a project that was attempting to syndicate news for a right-wing news service, because in the late 60s is basically when this whole right-wing machine was ginned up. Very, very quite literally on the principle that conservative ideas cannot withstand the scrutiny of math and historicity, so we have to create this entirely hermetic little existence where this shit can be real and seem real. So he tried that and it failed. He then in the... he was an advisor to the George H.W. Bush campaign, and that was the one with Lee Atwater and the Willie Horton ads. And it was one of the most explicitly nauseating race-baiting campaigns in modern history. And then he went and he helped when MSNBC was founded. I think his show was called like America's Talking, and created a couple of shows there. They didn't do well. He also, again, like displayed like the same nauseating interpersonal behavior there he had anywhere else. And then he was finally hired by Rupert Murdoch, and he's the reason why America and has Hannity and O'Reilly. And there, you know, he basically used the institutional power of Fox News to protect people like O'Reilly. I mean, this is the joke, like, you know, conservatives are great with money and they make, you know, smart, responsible decisions. This guy has been shuffling millions of dollars around since the early 2000s to make complaints that his talent and he himself can't stop hand fucking the women go away, because I guess News Corp would much rather waste that money disappearing lawsuits than, I don't know, just hire somebody who's semi-competent who doesn't try to rape people. So, like, you know, and I mean, okay, Ailes didn't try to rape people. He just sort of videotaped them and then, you know, like, psychologically manipulated them for years and years and years. And he did install glass desks at Fox News and said, I'm not paying you to wear slacks to the women. So they started wearing the short skirts. I mean, like, created this hostile, very emotionally and psychologically and professionally violating atmosphere. Maybe didn't cross that final frontier, but, you know, anyway, fuck him. Like, he, you know, if you were a Muslim in America, if you were a Latino in America, if you were black in America, if you were gay or trans in America, if you're a woman in America, all of you, your life is worse because this man lived.
Wow. So the ghoulish bit you're referring to was just me getting you to write it down, huh? You're quite fine to do that off the cuff.
No,
good stuff. No, that was good. You can't improve on that. Jeb, I just want to mention a couple of other really quick things before we go. Number one, this WannaCry worm that infected a lot of Windows XP systems around the world, not least of which was the NHS, the healthcare system in the UK, because of such an outdated computer system.
I thought you were going to say
this is completely unrelated.
I thought you were going to say, like, not least of which is my computer.
Fuck no. Absolutely. How dare you? I have the most up-to-date tech. No, Windows 10 all around for Timbo. But it has been an interesting real-time I told you so by a lot of people who, when the Vault 7 leaked happened, which was the accumulation of all of the cyber weapons that the NSA had accrued and put into one place inside their, you know, their repository. Someone had broken into that. A hacker managed to get that, and then these an organization called the Shadow Brokers leaked it. And Vault 7 was this big leak of all of these different tools that came out all at once, and it was only a matter of time before they got weaponized and used. And some of them had already. This is the most high-profile one that's happened so far. People like Ed Snowden, who was advocating for the NSA not stockpiling these weapons, but instead, when you find a vulnerability, the NSA really should have been telling people like Microsoft how to patch them, that this vulnerability existed, instead of sitting on it so that they could weaponize it for their own needs. Because, I mean, information wants to be free. This kind of stuff will get out. And so it was kind of inevitable that this shit was going to happen. And this is the first big public version that we've seen of it. It will certainly not be the last. This is probably, you can put a flag in the ground and say that this is the start of a new age of these cyber weapons starting to really fuck with the public, rather than just state actors who we sort of hear about these reports of attacks happening but don't really have an understanding of how it works. This is probably going to change now. Another bit of news is that Chelsea Manning has been released from prison now. She's free, and you can follow her on social media, and I have been, and it's just fantastic. She's posting photos of her eating pizza, and she posted a selfie up on Instagram, and it's just like, it's an incredible thing to see what this person looks like in the life that they're going to start living now. And it's quite uplifting for someone like me who considers Chelsea Manning a hero. It's like, this is a historic thing, and I haven't heard a lot of people talking about it. And I think that it's a tremendous thing and a bit of good news off the back of all this other bullshit that's happening. There is good stuff out there. So go and follow Chelsea Manning on Twitter and Instagram, and just follow that journey along when you need something to intersperse your impeachment hot takes for the day. So on that note, Jeb, do you want to add anything at the end?
Yeah, I have two announcements myself. The Chelsea Manning selfie was good. You know, like, she looks good. She looks happy. The pizza was dire. That was bad pizza, man. That was not...
like, it's all comparative.
That's like, I mean, that genuine, like, that piece of pizza, I looked at that and I was like, yeah, I would eat that only if I just left prison. But I do have an announcement, just sort of like unrelated to the hack. My new venture capital... I got some VC money for a startup. It's called iSlice. It's an Internet of Things product. What it does is it connects your block of knives in your kitchen to the World Wide Web. Can't see why anything would go wrong with that. In fact, we're gonna start connecting the internet to everything in your house. So you can,
if,
like,
it's got a blade, we want it connected, huh?
Yeah, like, I mean, you can, if you're, you know, like the Afghan that you kind of throw over the back of your couch, if it's a little crooked, you can move it a couple inches from work. I mean, you basically just need to wire everything in your house because there's not going to be any comeuppance. There's not going to be any blowback, especially because, the you know, in a couple of years, the internet is only going to be in 3% of households of the richest local dukes and shire reeves in America.
Well, Jim, if you're going to waste your chance to promote your own real life things that are out there, I'm going to promote it on your behalf. There's a great piece that Jeb's just written for Esquire that came out on Mother's Day called My Mom Was My Best Friend and I Was Kind of a Dick. And it is charming and wonderful. And I highly recommend everyone Google and read it right now. And you can follow the rest of Jeb's writing on Jeb Lund's Word Salad on Facebook.
Why, thank you. And after you've done that, please check out The Worst Idea of All Time, which is Tim's other podcast, his most famous one. It's in its victory lap season. Is that correct?
Yeah, fucking Zac Efron is in Sydney right now doing a junket for Baywatch, and I didn't realize. So we're in the same city, and I don't know if I can get in on the junket at this point in time. I think we've probably left it a bit late to tee that up, but I'm gutted. We're so close yet so far.
Well, I mean, I should let you go. I mean, you got to go steal some golf carts and just sort of like swarm them. That's what you want to do. Yeah. Swarm.
I'll go and do that. So we'll catch you guys soon. You can follow me at Tim_Bat on Twitter.
You can follow me at Mobute, Mobute on Twitter.
And we'll catch you again, hopefully, in 1 week's time.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Now, this Fox News alert, Roger Ailes has passed away. If you only know of him what you've read in recent months, then you didn't know him. Yes, he had his faults. We all do. I prefer to remember that Roger Ailes was generous, hilarious, and a genius. And if you enjoy the Fox News channel, you have Roger to thank for that.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.